From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week's show is devoted to data, which is being collected and crunched in breathtaking quantities at breakneck speed. According to The Economist, Walmart logs more than 2.5 petabytes of information about customer transactions every hour, equivalent to 167 times the books in the Library of Congress. News producers and news consumers love data. It's nonpartisan and predictable as arithmetic. But we've talked a lot on this show about data omitted or abused in medical journals, data stretched or muddled in political polls, baseless numbers bouncing like volleyballs from pundit to politician and back again. Data are so ubiquitous in media, we don't feel the need to belabor the point. Instead, we'll start by tying the data to you. On a recent New York evening, I attended a meetup of self-quantifiers, people who closely track a wide variety of their own behaviors or emotional and physical states at various points in the day or when engaged in activities ranging from cycling to sleeping or just living. That's what Sandy Santra does. He takes about 7,000 calls per year at his job at a computer help call desk. As he told the group,
I track yearly salary, blood pressure, migraines, time alone, happiness, meltdowns, that happens at work, panic attacks. I put new goals on a spreadsheet, and if I keep doing those push-ups every day, 21 days later, the goal turns from red to green. I'm there. I've made it a habit. What is all this? Data plus information compiled and organized turns into knowledge. It makes self-improvement inevitable. And I like that. Thank you.
Some of the young men and women, mostly men here, embrace self-quantification variously as a creed. Others pursue it as a hobby or a health plan, business opportunity, or art project. Lori Frick graphs the peaks and valleys of her sleep and turns them into art pieces that possess a soothing visual rhythm.
I mean, everybody thinks sleep holds secrets, right? It's this thing, you know, you go to bed at night, you wake up in the morning, what happened in between?
Do you know what happens in between?
I see exactly how many times I wake up during the night. I know how much I dreamt. I see how many minutes I spend in deep sleep. I see exactly in the morning what happened.
At this meetup, Lori showed her art. Sandy delivered his mission statement, and NYU student Matt Ganeshow talked about his school project, designed to redirect the attention of self-quantifiers outward. Basically, when someone enlisted in Ganeshow's project runs into another person in the project, he or she silently assesses the other's mood, according to a standard medical pain scale chart. But before doing that, that person must first assess his own mood.
So that creates two data points. You end up with a graph of how you perceive yourself to be versus how your community perceives yourself to be.
Ganeshow says that the very technology enabling us to escape into self-quantification cocoons also holds the potential to expand our self-absorption to larger and larger communities in a kind of feedback loop.
Because the more that I look at you and the more that I try to see, are you doing okay, the more information I am going to get back. And it may be a technology trick, but if we can actually have technology train us to look at each other again, then it doesn't become I'm monitoring my scale 100 days so I can lose weight and it's my bubble. It becomes, how are you doing with your progress? And then how are they doing? And how are they doing? And then let's aggregate that together and say, how collectively are we doing?
MIT researcher Deb Roy talked about his project in a March TED Talk.
Imagine if you could record your life, everything you said, everything you did, so you could go back and find memorable moments and relive them, or sift through traces of time and discover patterns in your own life that previously had gone undiscovered. Well, that's exactly the journey that my family began 5.5 years ago.
He described how he recorded 90,000 hours of video from every angle of his son's first years as he acquired language, and he offered an audio portrait akin to time-lapse photography of how, over the passage of time, the baby, then toddler, learned to say water.
He sure nailed it, didn't he?
Roy then shifted from his child's acquisition of language to a public online response to the president's State of the Union address, a light show of data points coalescing around words and ideas captured and quantified in all manner of electronic communication. He called it a real-time pulse of the nation activated by content.
The idea is this: as our world becomes increasingly instrumented and we have the capabilities to collect and connect the dots, it's like building a microscope or a telescope and revealing new structures about our own behavior around communication. And I think the implications here are profound, whether it's for science, for commerce, for government, but perhaps most of all, for us as individuals.
So, all those individual unique data points have the potential to reveal our society's workings. Good stuff. But amassing all that revelatory data demands that we all engage in staggering amounts of self-tracking. What does all that navel-gazing do to us? Gary Wolf, contributing editor of Wired and co-founder of The Quantified Self, a blog about, quote, self-knowledge through numbers, started this whole thing, so I pummeled him with my fears.
We hear a lot at The Quantified Self the worry that this is just the ultimate stage in a kind of narcissistic apocalypse, so that we will soon not notice anything that goes on more than a few inches from our own nose.
Well said.
I think that that is a fear without a foundation. And one of the things that happens when people begin to pay attention to themselves in new ways is that they see in a different light what they have in common with other people.
What keeps us optimistic is a sort of fantasy of who we are and what we might become. And don't we run the risk of losing hope when confronted with the harsh numerical reality of what we really are?
I think that's a very good question. There is a whole industry devoted to selling the possibility of change to people. For instance, health clubs, which see that huge uptick in membership after January 1st. And many, many things that we see in our consumer culture are based on hopes that never come true. And one of the things that happens in The Quantified Self is people begin to see how related all of their behaviors are and how difficult it is to change one thing in isolation and then at the same time how difficult it is to change many things at once. On the one hand, this is discouraging, whether it's weight loss or extreme improvements in happiness or great leaps of productivity. The promise of radical change is one of the things that we live on in our society. At the same time, I think trading fantasies of radical change for possibilities of small, important changes is a trade-off worth making.
Do you think it makes us smarter than our consumer culture?
I hope it does.
If you track yourself over a long period of time, you will inevitably quantify your own physical and cognitive decline, right?
Yes.
That's depressing.
We probably do need to tune up our capacity to handle that truth, especially as our demographic shift, at least in this country, towards an older population creates incentive to sell people fantasies that their cognitive decline is ultimately preventable rather than merely manageable. When you fail to see those clear, realistic limits, you're vulnerable to being exploited and you're vulnerable to terrible crashes. So I think the overall effect of this is very healthy, but not easy.
What do you think is the most powerful truth you learned about yourself from self-quantifying?
I track my exercise time and my work time, and I have a meditation practice that I track. And one of the things that became clear that was absolutely fascinating to me was that attempting to increase the quantity of good things that I did too much caused a complete rebound effect.
Really?
Oh, yes. The advice to go for it, you know, this is advice that is pretty common. And in my case, at least, it was really pernicious. And you could see really clearly that when, due to some influence or some ambition, I attempted to turn a steady habit of doing something up by a lot, a short period of increased activity, say increased physical exercise, and then zero on the chart for weeks.
I think I can duplicate your results.
I think it's more common than people realize. And, you know, this is really fascinating to think that really the advice for people who are trying to do something is do as little as you possibly can in the right direction and see what happens. And if that works, do another tiny little bit in that direction.
And only available through the quantified self approach.
It's not that you can't find suggestions about what to do. The value for many people in the quantified self is creating a feedback loop that's customized for them so that they can do something as simple as find out whether what they are trying to do is working at all, and even find out what it is that they're actually doing.
Gary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gary Wolf is co-founder of the blog The Quantified Self. This is On the Media.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.